Western Inland Sea podcast, and I'm here with my my guest James Corbett. He runs the Corbett Report, and does a lot of articles online about globalization, about the, can I call it the New World Order? Can we call it that now, James? Is that what we're still calling it?
Well, I don't call it that, but George Soros and Henry Kissinger and David Rockefeller and all of them repeatedly call it that. So I guess that's the name we'll use for the conversation.
Exactly. What would you call it? A consolidation of corporate power? Political power?
I would call it the global mafia. I mean, let's not put flowers around this fetid pile of turd. I mean, that's basically what we're dealing with, is just a global gang, a syndicate that wants to control basically the resources of the world, and that includes the human resources, and who have been working diligently towards that task for generations. So they like to dress it up and give it all this flowery rhetoric, but really that's all it is. It's just a gang of thugs.
And they've done a really good job at it, too. I mean, when you talk about the New World Order, people, they roll their eyes at you. If they don't, there's no New World Order. They might talk about it, but if there's no New World Order.
That's exactly right. I mean, it's part of the conditioning that the public has been under for a long time now. And it's interesting to think a century ago, it was quite apparent to most of the people in society who were the real controllers of society. And that's why a century ago, when the Federal Reserve was coming into existence, they had to play quite a bit of tricks on the public to get the Federal Reserve Act passed, including pretending to oppose the Federal Reserve Act and then passing it in the middle of a closed session of the Senate, which wasn't closed in the proper manner. So it was still able to pass legislation even on, I believe it was Christmas Eve or December 23rd. I can't remember which date, but it was right there in the midst of the winter break when they managed to pass the Federal Reserve Act, when most of the senators had already gone home. So it was something they had to slip in the back door, because most of the people back 100 years ago knew that banking really was the center of not only the economy, but really society itself. And they knew that the people in charge of the banks were the ones who had been in charge of society for a very long time. Fast forward 100 years, and hardly one in 100 people even really understand what the Federal Reserve is, let alone why it's important to our society. So unfortunately, yes, we've been dumbed down over a period of generations, and this is the end result, where even talking about the oligarchy that controls society and has for generations gets provokes eye rolls in the politically correct yuppies who will just parrot whatever the mainstream talking heads are telling them.
Well, it's indoctrinated into our youth. It's indoctrinated everywhere, you know, from the schools. You know, we're taught from a very young age that this is the way it is, and, you know, they're always right. And, you know, so after all that indoctrination, after 20 years of indoctrination, it's hard to for me, it was hard to break that kind of superstition.
And for me as well, I'm sure for a lot of people out there. I don't know about yourself or your listeners, but I grew up in the Canadian public indoctrination system, and there was an awful lot of propaganda, including the Model UN and all of that kind of thing, that they try to steep us in to make us believe that the inevitable global government is going to be the savior of humanity. And I think we've seen a lot of placement for that idea in the last several years. And one of the ideas of sort of the American imperialist regime out of control, waging illegal wars of aggression all around the world, is to set up this idea that the United Nations Security Council and the UN generally is going to be the savior. And lo and behold, that's what we're seeing with Syria now. It seems kind of a UN diplomatic wheelings and dealings is going to be behind the disarming of Assad and the defusing of the situation. And so, again, it seems that the global government is being posited as the answer to a problem that the people who are going to make up that global government themselves created.
Once again, it's never about the people, though. I mean, these warmongers, these bankers never see the casualties. They never have to look at that. It's only the people going on the front lines fighting these wars that get to see any of the bloodshed, any of the heartache of these people, these poor people that are, you know, slaughtered en masse.
That's quite true, and that applies not only to the people who are directing the wars, but also to the people increasingly who are waging them from the safety of their little bases in the United States, where they're controlling the drones halfway around the world that are dropping bombs on people's head. I mean, we've managed to detach humanity from war to such an extent that it's now basically little more than a glorified video game for the people who are waging it, which is, I mean, I think the only way you can really get people to commit atrocities on the scale of what is now possible is to detach them from the actual consequences of what they're doing. And I think this has been shown throughout time, throughout history. If you look at the major wars of the early 20th century, for example, it was it took an awful lot of training to get people to actually fire and kill their opponents on the battlefield more often than not. And that required decades of learning how to train people to do automatic response firing and the like in order to get the firing rate and the hit rate up above 10%, where I believe it was something like that in World War One, and now we they've managed to get that up even further. But of course, that becomes less and less relevant as more and more warfare is being waged either from bombs being dropped from the sky by pilots or from bombs being dropped from the sky by robots.
Little known fact in the military that there's something called soldier's right to miss. So he doesn't have to hit his enemy. But I think they're trying to do away with that now, too. Like
Even heard of that concept. But
yeah, David Swanson wrote a book called War's a Lie. And he talks about that there's something called soldier's right to miss. And they can't really punish you for missing. You know, you were doing your job in the field. Not a lot of soldiers know that, though, because they don't want you to know that, obviously.
Of course, yeah. No, I'm sure that's part of the indoctrination that they get as well, but that little factoid is probably left out of basic training.
Probably. Oh, no. We want maximum kills here. And I find that disgusting. And that's just it. You know, when we were talking about Iraq, we're talking about a million lives. Maybe more now. But when I think about a million people, you know, dead, that terrifies me.
Well, there were a series of blasts just yesterday in Iraq that claimed 40 more lives. And of course, the Boston Marathon bombing can kill, what was it, two or three people? And that's mainstream news in the United States for days. And it's this major event that's going to have major geopolitical ramifications and the entire country goes into mourning. But 40 dead in just another day is just another day in Iraq.
Just another day at the office.
Yeah.
I know, it's disgusting. And it leads me to my question of, you're in Japan. What is the overall feeling of America from Japan, from the Japanese people? Because I when I think of America, I think of us being quite egocentric.
I think the opinion here is probably quite polarized, and it's difficult to gauge directly because there's this concept in Japanese society, tatemae and honmae, which means sort of the what you do, what you say in public, and then what you really feel. So I think the best way to gauge what the public is really feeling in Japan is to read the online comments of the netizens, because I think that's where they let that guard down. And in that regard, I would say that definitely Japanese society is shifting. I would say for a good part of the last half century, it's been a very pro American society and U.S. flags and, you know, U.S. sort of camaraderie has been part of, drilled into Japanese society for a long time.
Is that out of fear?
Sorry?
Is that out of fear?
Well, I'm sure that might have something to do with it. Stockholm syndrome, maybe?
Right,
Loving your captor. I'm not sure what it is, but I think that just speaks to Japanese society's incredible flexibility in the way that they adopted almost like flipping a light switch after World War II. It's like, well, they won, let's become them.
Right.
And so it is a fascinating aspect of Japanese society, but I would say that that's changing. And I would say there's definitely a growing resentment of U.S. military presence here. And certainly in Okinawa, I think that that is boiling over and threatening to come to a head as things continue to degenerate there. I mean, a few years ago, we had a prime minister here come to power on the back of a promise to try to get the U.S. out of Okinawa, and that fell apart pretty much as soon as he came into office. So I think people are getting frustrated with the idea that there will ever be a political eschewing of the U.S. and the U.S. military umbrella. And I think there's a growing understanding that the U.S. is really just an imperialist power that's getting out of control. And one of the interesting reflections of that, I was last month, I was in Tokyo at the Foreign Correspondence Club, where we were having a meeting with some of the people who had attended a Korean peace conference, who had come over to Japan to attend the Japanese side of that conference. So they were speaking at the Foreign Correspondence Club, talking about this. And after their speeches talking about how the U.S. was the imperialist power that was getting in the way of peace on the Korean Peninsula, after each one of their speeches, there was applause from the audience, which I was told afterwards is almost completely unheard of at the Foreign Correspondents Club. I mean, it's basically reporters who are just there covering it for their newspaper or whatever, but they were actually applauding the speeches. So I think there is a growing resentment of U.S. policies, and I think that is striking a chord more and more with the Japanese people.
Do you think that will eventually come home to America? I mean, because what I think is we're not going to have the manpower to fight all of our enemies eventually. You know what I mean?
Well, I think so. I think that is, in fact, part of the long-term plan. I think that ultimately, when we're talking about the grand plan for a new world order, I think that definitely involves taking the American imperial machine that they've built up, taking that down in a pretty spectacular fashion. And part of that will just be the, I think, world backlash at this American exceptionalism, as Putin pointed out in his New York Times op-ed. No country is special or better than any other and should not have any special place to do whatever it wants. And America is no different. And I know that's a shocking concept for some Americans, but it's one that the rest of the world certainly does feel strongly and will probably be made known more strong terms to the United States as it continues to basically collapse internally, economically, and then externally through the overstretching of its military resources.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I don't think that a lot of Americans understand what's on the way, what will be the future of America. And it's a pretty scary thought.
To be fair to the American people, though, I think that they are starting to understand, and I think that the public is probably more advanced in that understanding than the politicians would have you believe. And probably the most stunning example of that has been with the incredible kickback that we saw with regards to this recent intervention in Syria, or the proposed intervention. And it may have been motivated on the part of many Americans just to say, well, we can't afford to be in another war, and you know, we should be spending that money at home. And maybe that's not such a noble anti-war sentiment, but at any rate, it does show that the American public is more and more aware that the real problems are at home, and the politicians are only interested in foreign adventurism for the purposes of basically enriching the oligarchy. And I think that that is something that more and more people really do understand.
Then you had guys like Ron Paul that wanted a non-interventionist policy, and he was kind of laughed off the stage by these by the oligarchy, basically.
Well, you know, he wants to go back to the 19th century. He's just an isolationist. He's a weirdo. He's fringe. He's a lunatic. Most of the people agree with him. But still, it doesn't matter. This is a democracy. We have to go with what the oligarchy wants.
Exactly, exactly. And so being part of the alternative media, do you think it's been co-opted or controlled in a sense?
Well, I guess you'd have to narrow down the terms of that question, because obviously the alternative media encompasses such a broad range
of
alternative outlets and outlets that claim to be alternative. So I think there's quite a range of things to deal with there.
Because to me, it's like it's created a lot of heroes, like your Alex Jones. And I know you've been on his show. I'm not doing this to bash Alex Jones. I think he says a lot of good things. But do you think he is the real deal, or is he kind of just going along with it? I mean, he makes $5 million a year. So I'm kind of...
Right. Well, my take is I believe that he does believe in what he's doing, and regardless of whether he believes in it or not, I mean, it was his work that really did kickstart me and motivate me to start the Corbett Report. So if he is some kind of CIA plant or whatever, he's doing a terrible job of it. But
I agree with you. I'm on his side, too. I think he does good work. But.
Right. I understand the kind of misgivings that people have about a figure in the alternative media becoming kind of mainstreamized. I mean, he's as mainstream, I guess, as alternative media gets. And I think that there is, just as in any movement, there is the danger of putting leaders into positions of leadership and people venerating certain figures rather than concentrating on the information. But I think that's just kind of a human failing. And I understand it. I mean, people are looking for leaders. They want figures that will come along and show them what to do and tell them what to do, that they can basically follow orders, because that's what a lot of people actually want in their lives. And I understand that. So it's a difficult kind of catch-22 for the alternative media movement, because, again, even in my own situation, I mean, I'm wary of ever becoming that type of figure that people would look to as an authority on this or that. I mean, all I've ever wanted to do is try to convey information that hopefully people can verify for themselves. And that's what I continually stress. But sometimes I wonder, I mean, how many people are actually checking the links that I provide in my show notes, and how many people are just kind of taking what I say at face value. And it always gives me pause for thought to think that there might be people out there that are basically just falling into the same traps that the mainstream media have had us in for generations. And all it would take is people with nefarious intentions to come along and pose as the alternative and basically get people back on board with the mainstream just by pretending to be alternative.
You know, and I think that the mainstream understands what's going on with the alternative media. And people, more people are turning to it because they turn on CNN and all you see is Syria. But a year ago, no one knew where Syria was. I mean, the people in the know, like you and I, and you know, even Alex Jones, knew about that memo that came out, or that report from that general. Now I'm on the spot here, and I can't even remember who it was. But he said they were taking out several different countries, Syria, Iran.
General Wesley Clark.
Wesley Clark, yeah. Thank you for backing me up here. So all this is in the plan.
Yes, it is. I mean, obviously, Syria is just the next on the chopping block, and that has been derailed for the time being, but I don't imagine that we're quite done with that story yet. But it is interesting to see the way that all came about and how that was handled and how Putin has really emerged as the much stronger leader, if you will, in all of this, which is interesting. But again, I think the meta level of the analysis here is to be wary of the enemy of our enemy is our friend kind of thinking, because I think that always gets us into trouble as people maybe. I know there are people who venerate figures like Putin and who used to venerate, for example, Chavez and people like that, because they're the roadblock to American imperialism in South America or in the Middle East or what have you. And I understand that perspective, but then I think that we also have to be extremely wary of these leaders in and of themselves, and not to delude ourselves that if they were in the position that America is in, that they would be fundamentally any different.
Right. Would they continue the same path? Because America is, you know, the probably the biggest superpower the world's ever known. But we are going down a similar path, you know, where, you know, the thing is all roads lead to Rome or whatever, you know. So we're going down that direction. Is that really the model everyone wants to follow now? I mean, what is a new model we can kind of adopt? Is there a better way?
Absolutely.
Just kind of...
And it's important for us to really reflect at the most meta level that we can about what's happening and what the real solution would be to that. And I think that when we look at it realistically with a cold, hard analysis, what it shows is that every single move that's being made geopolitically now, whether it be from the American imperial side and the NATO war side, or whether it be from the other side, the Chinese or the Russians or whoever, you know, is trying to put the roadblocks in the way of that and trying to argue for national sovereignty and the like, it's still at the end of the day about centralization of power, whether it be in national governments, whether it be in the UN or some sort of global governmental system. They're all still on board with the agenda ultimately that power has to be centralized in the hands of a few. So the only real opposition to that, that's actually genuinely opposed to what these self-appointed leaders are doing, is to decentralize that power. And that is an extremely large undertaking that will have to be done piecemeal. I'm under no delusions about that. But I think that the ultimate end road of the opposite to what they're doing would be individualism, where power is decentralized back down to the level of the individual. And that's called anarchy and made to sound very scary to people. And people have been conditioned again for generations that anarchy is just people with bombs who are just trying to kill people for no reason. And it's just mayhem and chaos and bedlam. But I think we have to start looking at the ways that decentralization of power is the only real roadblock to the seemingly inevitable march towards world government.
I mean, to a rigid politician, anarchy is no different than terrorism.
Yes, and I can't remember which congressman or senator came out recently and was calling the Tea Party anarchists and how they don't want government and they're no better than these bomb throwers and what have you, which is, I mean, it's an interesting I think it was Harry Reid. I'll have to look that up. But at any rate, there was a prominent American politician recently coming out pontificating on how the Tea Party are anarchists because they don't like government. And I don't know. I mean, I think he might want to check, for example, the polls that show that Congress has, what, a 9-10% approval rating these days?
If that. Yeah. And now, shouldn't that be a slight indication that – here's the thing. When you're in school, you get graded. You get grades. If you have 50%, you fail. You're out. Shouldn't that be something we should be looking into? If Congress has 6%, maybe they shouldn't be there. They're not doing their jobs.
Not only that, but I would say that just the voter participation, the voter turnout, should be in itself an indication of how much stock the American people put into the political system. Because when you get voter turnout that's below 50%, so less than half of the people who can actually cast a vote bother to, in a system that has reified and glorified and deified the voting process and made it into this thing, oh, it's your natural born right and duty as a patriotic American citizen, it's the greatest thing in the history of humanity, blah blah blah, you get to pull a lever once every 4 years to vote for which side of the oligarchy you want ruling over you.
It's nationalism at its most disgusting.
It really is, and it plays on some exceptionally deep base urges in the human psychology. So I understand why people get drawn into that and red versus blue and all of this stuff. They do
play for your team.
People's, yeah, they play on people's basic primal urges. So I understand why it's so appealing and so ingrained. But the fact that over half of the public doesn't even bother to pull that lever every 4 years, I think in itself speaks volumes to how effective people think that process really is.
Well, I mean, take a look at one. I wanted to not get into 9/11, but I think when we're talking, I think it's absolutely important to keep up the discussion of 9/11, because what people don't realize is that no matter who was involved, there are criminal things going on in this, and they need to be taken care of. Otherwise, it's going to just perpetuate more criminal activity in the future if these people are not tried for war crimes.
I agree wholeheartedly, and of course people who have been watching any of my 9/11 anniversary coverage would know that that's very much my sentiment these days. But I mean, even if you were just to look at something, an issue like the 9/11 insider trading, which has been proven statistically to have taken place. There was an article by Alan Potishman in, I think it was the Journal of Business Studies back in 2006, that proved statistically that there was insider trading, there was unusual market activity there, and the conclusion of that paper was that it is the conclusion of this paper that there was inside knowledge of the attacks that were used to trade these stocks. So people can go and look up that paper. I mean, that's just one example of something exceptionally concrete that we have, that we know that there was foreknowledge of the attacks and people trading on them, and yet the SEC stopped their investigation because the people who were tied to those trades didn't have any conceivable ties to Al-Qaeda and thus couldn't have been responsible.
Right.
So that's just one example of how there was demonstrable criminal activity taking place around the events of that day that were never followed up and never prosecuted. And exactly as you say, if the American people allow the oligarchy to get away with moves like that and do not hold the people who were responsible for those transactions accountable, then it will not only double or triple, but I mean, it will grow exponentially from here. And I think, unfortunately, the last 12 years has shown to a lot of people who may have been incredulous about 9/11 that certainly, undeniably, it is getting worse and worse, and the corruption is just becoming almost unbelievable these days.
It's unbearable. When you look at after 9/11, the Patriot Act was put into effect, and it was done pretty much like the Federal Reserve Act, you know, under a blanket of secrecy. But then you have Obama coming out later and pushing through the NDAA, which was done the exact same way, and all these bills that are, you know, completely unconstitutional.
It's been the systematic shredding of the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, more importantly, but exactly right. I mean, this has been almost I would love to be able to travel back in time 15 years and to tell people about what the America would look like in 2013 and to watch their jaws drop and then roll their eyes and say that would never happen in America.
Just like they do with everything else.
Exactly right. And that's exactly all it is just a question of just give it enough time and just do it slowly enough that the public will – and give, of course, the right events to sort of be the mask and the cover for what's going on. But, of course, we know that a lot of this was in motion before 9/11 as well. I mean, the Department of Homeland Security had already been proposed. The Patriot Act had already been written. There had already been terrorism legislation that had been tried in Congress before this point, the Anti-Terrorism Bill of 1995, etc.
Bill Clinton, right?
Yes. In fact, yeah. Joe Biden later bragged that, well, we basically did have the Patriot Act back in 1995. We wrote the first draft of it. Again, all of this has been coalescing for a long time. But of course, 9/11 provides the perfect pretext for bringing it all out into the open. And unfortunately, people have been steeped in it so long that there is a generation growing up who has literally known nothing different in their lives. And that to me is the scary part, because I think there will always be people in the older age groups who will remember there was a time before 9/11 and before all this ridiculous hysteria. But for people who have never known anything different in their lives, it's going to be very difficult to convince them that this is an unusual state of affairs.
Right. I have to, give 9/11 some credit, not because it was – obviously it was a horrible tragedy, but it opened my eyes. I mean, I didn't think any differently than anybody else out there before 9/11 happened. But, after you start seeing the huge errors in reporting and just, the glaringly obvious things that were happening, you can't ignore them.
I agree, and I think that's one of the effects of these mass level events. I think one of the ideas of the black operations, especially when they're so obvious in certain details, is that it really does force people at a certain level, whether consciously or not, to kind of choose sides. It's are you going to square up to the reality, or are you simply going to cover your ears and go along with it? And unfortunately, every time that this type of event comes along, there is a section of the population that will decide, well, I'm just going to go with the official story. Everyone else is crazy, conspiracy theorist. I'll shut my ears and say la, la, la. And when they do that, they really are making a conscious commitment to go further and further and deeper and deeper into this tyranny. And they will become the sort of shock troops of the tyranny as it continues to develop, because they've already committed themselves to it. So I think part of the glaringly obvious nature of these black operations is to get people to really make that decision. And so some people do snap out of it, like myself and yourself, but there are many others who decide not to. And I think it's similar to events like, of course, JFK, which we're coming up to the 50th anniversary. Mm-hmm. Again, pretty obviously, pretty transparently not the story that they want us to believe. But the fact that they continue to tell us that is just so much cognitive dissonance and probably too much for some people to handle.
Well, that's just it. They've been telling it for so long, and it's been passed down. And I fear that that's going to be the legacy of 9/11 is eventually. I know people are waking up now, but the establishment have a way of knocking them back to sleep.
It's true, and that is my fear as well. But I think that we've already seen some substantive progress that I think 9/11 Truth has made. And I think that is coming about, maybe not necessarily towards achieving the actual justice for the events themselves, although that should obviously still be our priority. But I think at any rate, going forward from here, I think it would be much, much more difficult to stage an attack like that and to get people to just blindly go along with it and give the administration a carte blanche for whatever it wanted to do in the wake of that, because there is a lot more skepticism that I think has grown out of the efforts of the 9/11 Truth Movement to educate the public about false flag terrorism. And I think that really has started to pay dividends when we start to see the immediate and quite mainstream public backlash against some of these false flag events or attempted events, including and up to this recent Syrian chemical weapons attack, where even a lot of mainstream people were at the very least pondering whether or not this was an event that took place, whether whether it was an Assad-launched event, whether it wasn't the rebels. So I think we are starting to break through that paradigm, and that is a concrete thing that I think we shouldn't downplay the significance of that, because it really does make it much more difficult, I think, for a 9/11 type event to work in the future.
Well, do you think that when knowing about these false flags, and when we see something or hear something that happens, most of us will immediately go, oh, false flag, when it might not be anything like that. But when you're in there, you're like, oh, that's definitely a false flag. But do you know what I mean?
Right. I know exactly what you mean.
You jump to that right away almost.
Right. And sometimes it can be eye rolling, because from my own perspective, I want to see what kind of evidence there might be before I make a decision on that. But to a certain extent, I think that there does have to be a burden of proof somewhere. And I would much rather that burden of proof be on the government to try to prove that it is the way they say it is, rather than on the alternative media to prove that it wasn't the way the government
says it. I agree.
So I think that if the default position is, I don't believe what the government's saying, they better prove it to me, that's for the good. And so I noticed, for example, in the wake of the Osama bin Laden raid
debacle,
I just noticed immediately how ridiculous it was that we were being asked to believe this entire narrative of what happened there without one single shred of evidence. And when I saw them come out and say, yeah, and we dumped his body at sea before anyone had a chance to do anything about it, I mean, that to me was just so ludicrous. And I think that there were a lot of people out there who were also had their radar kind of going pinging off of that event, because again, just them asking us just to take our word for it, we just told you what happened.
Yeah, we've never lied before,
and we won't provide any proof, and we'll go to absurd lengths to cover up the proof, as we now know the Pentagon actually illegally transferred some of their data over to the CIA so that it could be classified. Which could not have been the case if the Pentagon had kept it in their records. So all sorts of shenanigans have gone on regarding that event, and I think that's just another example of this phenomenon.
Exactly. I found it really funny. I mean, I was at work, and everyone was like, oh, they caught Bin Laden. I was like, really? It's for the ninth time?
Yeah.
I mean, people are so gullible. I mean, and they just believe whatever they're told. And I was like, no, listen. So I had to go on this gigantic rant, and I probably looked crazy.
Well, it's good to look crazy to people who are believing in things that are crazy, because that means you're probably on the right track.
Right,
well, it doesn't
right.
guarantee that you're on the right track, but at any rate, it means that you're not on their track of craziness.
Right. We're on different levels of crazy, I suppose. But wait a minute. It's been a half an hour, and I know you have to go, but I would love to chat with you again sometime. It's been a lot of fun and enlightening, and anytime you want to come on again, you
Excellent.
Let me know.
Well, I appreciate you having me on, and anytime you want me on, just let me know, and I'll make the time.
Sounds good, James. I appreciate it. Take care.
All right. Thank you. Okay.